So we have some time now to respond to any questions that anybody might have about the practice, about the teachings, about things that I've said. Anything that is not clear or causing problems. We have this, which is means that I won't have to repeat the question. So if you'd be willing to use this, if you have a question, we can make sure that it gets passed to you. I think it works. Yeah. So is there anything anybody wanted to ask about? Don't be put off by this, it's just a bit of technology. You have a question? Yeah, good. Okay.
I have a question about Metta Sutta. In that, there is a term used, unburdened with duties. And I would like to understand more. And even, like, sort of, I feel unsure about what my duties are, and what exactly it means by unburdened with duties.
You could just keep it, actually. Yeah. I mean, there are different ways this is spoken about.
I can hear the question.
Oh, okay. So the question was. That's okay. Nita, isn't it? Yeah, Nita was wondering about the phrase in the Metta Sutta where it says unburdened with duties, you know, the discourse on loving kindness, and a question about what her duties are and what does it mean to be unburdened. Unburdened with duties. I like this question. It's something I've talked about before, because sometimes we can hear that, and what we hear is, "Well, I shouldn't have any duties." That's because duties are a burden. And I mean, I have heard that spoken about, like when one becomes a nun or a monk, you're actually, the focus becomes much more on like the duty of liberating the heart, the duty to practice, and you don't have the same duties as a householder with regard to looking after your house, your family, paying the bills and going to work and so on. So there are people who say that that's what it means. You know, you just try to have as few duties as possible, and so your whole focus can be on practice and liberating the heart. But what I find a much more helpful understanding, and certainly looking at some of the monastic people, particularly the more senior people, and I happens to me too, is that we seem to end up with an awful lot of duties. Masses of duties, and so you think, well, you know, am I doing something wrong? I've got all these duties. And then what I like to do is to consider, well, what do we mean by being unburdened with duties? You know, how can we kind of marry the fact of having a great many duties and a great many things that one's responsible for and the idea of not being burdened, being unburdened with duties? And so the way that I work with that is to see that we can have plenty of duties, but whether we make them into a burden is something we do have some control over. You know, I've known people with actually very few things to do, and they seem to be very burdened with just, you know, very few duties. And I also know other people who have an enormous number of responsibilities and who don't give the impression of being burdened. Ajahn Amaro, when he first came here as abbot, he was on something like 15 different committees. And yet he was able to kind of stop and attend to each person. You know, he was always there at breakfast and available to speak with people. It wasn't, and obviously quite enjoying it, you know, not, it wasn't like it was a burden. So my sense is that the knack is to learn how to, you know, if you have got duties, and we all have duties of one kind or another, how to pick them up when it's appropriate, but not to carry them round. You know, so, you know, I could sit down and list all the things that I'm involved with, you know, the English Sangha Trust publications, none. But feel burdened by it. But what I find is more helpful is just, okay, well, right now, you know, so precisely right now, I'm part of this retreat, and right now I'm, you know, responding to questions. That's my duty is actually to be present. And something else that, which is a little, well, the other day I was, that's right, it was a little meeting up at the Hermitage of our trust, and I realised I'd been kind of worrying about it a bit, you know, sort of having, you know, all the right bits of paper and understanding how the insurance worked and things like that. And I thought, come on, Chandasri, your duty as a nun is to enjoy life. And that totally transformed the whole thing, because that's what the Buddha, you know, wants for us. It's not that we, you know, carry our life and our duties around as a burden, but more that it's these are things that we do, you know. I think the word duty is a little bit unfortunate, because I think, you know, certainly in the English language is a sense of, you know, duty seems like something that's a burden. Like to be unburdened with duties is like a contradiction in terms. But if we just see duty as being, well, this is something that I do, you know, it's something I do as part of my life. And you can do it in a way that makes a burden out of it, or you can do it in a way that's, you know, really joyful. Opportunity. You can enjoy it. You can enjoy your duties. They're not. It's not contradictory. So that's how I would see it. And I said this duty to enjoy life was something that came to me more recently. It's like with mindfulness. You know, when we're really present, you know, we're not allowing ourselves to get overwhelmed with the burdens, the things that we need to do. And if there is a sense of overwhelm, then we bring mindfulness to that, you know, and we realize, well, I can only do one thing at a time, so I might as well give my full attention to this one thing, and then when I've done that, I can do the next thing, rather than sort of carrying the whole long list around with you wherever you go. You know, it's there, you know that that these are things that need to be attended to, and you just attend to them one at a time, according to your capacity, and maybe some things will have to be left undone. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that was the confusion, that whether it is about renouncing duties.
Yes.
So having minimal duties, or
yes,
it is about having right relationship with duties, like you said,
yeah,
not having too much attachment or aversion. So that was the...
Yes.
I was considering that which way Buddha is suggesting.
Well, I think that they both work in terms of the practice, but I think the one that is more useful, like for all of us, you know, because we all have plenty of duties, it's not is to consider how we can carry them lightly, you know, not to make a burden out of them. Yeah. Good. There's a section in our monastic training, which is called the section on the 14 kichawata, which are sometimes translated as duties. And another way that it can be spoken about is these things to be done. You know, so like the, you know, sometimes you say that the duties of, you know, when you visit a monastery, the duties when you leave a monastery, the duties towards seniors, the duties towards juniors. And, you know, you can see, oh, all these duties. But you can also see, well, this is how we do it. You know, and the Buddha, you know, made very clear directions as to how these things could be done quite methodically. So it's like a way of making them light. You know, this is just what we do. You know, when a visiting elder comes, we treat them in this way. You know, when we're going away somewhere, we do this. We go to the shrine, we pay respects, we take leave. So it's more just like things to be done in a particular way. And you can call them duties and make a big thing about it, or you can just call it, well, you know, this is what we do. Yeah. Yes, let's get the microphone. You might need to turn it on. Sorry. You need to speak loud and clear.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay, I have a question that sounds quite simple. It's I think you mentioned the parameters yesterday, and I think two of it was compassion and kindness. Is that right?
Compassion's not on the list of parameters.
Oh, it's not. Oh, okay.
But kindness is, metta.
Okay.
Compassion comes in the list of the Brahmaviharas.
Oh, okay.
And it comes in the list of skillful ways of thought. Thinking that supports mindfulness and well-being, and the aspiration to nibbana.
Well, my question really is, what's the difference between the two? Because to me, it's the same thing: compassion and kindness, metta. Uh-huh. Is it not the same thing?
Metta karuna.
Yes.
Okay, I can talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
And in case anybody didn't hear, Minnie's question was the difference between compassion and kindness, metta and karuna. I mean, they do overlap, certainly. And there are aspects of compassion that, it's in a way, it's almost like playing with words to some degree. But metta is more like a sense of kindness, a sense of acceptance, both of people, of situations, a whole attitude in meditation. That's like giving space to things. So we can have metta for small insects, metta for people that we like, metta for people that we don't like, metta for ourselves, which is just, as I said, like a kind of attitude of acceptance, of giving space. Karuna is more attuned to the suffering of others. It's more like wanting to do something more active to alleviate suffering. So it's like a step on from kindness. But they do, they kind of, as I said, they kind of overlap. Both of these qualities, though, it's important to begin with ourselves. So the way I understand it, that, you know, the more that we can accept all the aspects of our own character, the things that we like, the things that we don't like, the things that we feel pleased about and glad about, the things that we feel embarrassed about and ashamed of, with metta, we encompass it all with an attitude of, okay, this is okay, this is fine. Not that we approve of it necessarily or think it's great, but at least giving space rather than the opposite, which is, you know, constantly trying to get rid of what we don't like and hold on to what we do like, always kind of picking and choosing. With metta, there's a kind of acceptance of it all, not necessarily a condoning, as I said, but an acceptance as a basis from which one can, you know, if necessary, one can make changes, one can take steps to, you know, alter habits or respond to things in a different way. So I always say that with metta, rather than feeling that we've got to be kind to everybody else, when we haven't actually fully accepted and learned how to be kind to ourselves, it doesn't always work that way round. So sometimes I've been in situations where, you know I should be kind to somebody, and I can't quite manage it. And then I look inwards and I see, well, that's because they're mirroring something that I haven't really accepted in myself, you know, that I don't like in myself. And so I can be quite impatient, quite dismissive with particular characteristics that might, that other people might show, manifest. Over the years, as I've been practicing and contemplated my own life to a much greater degree and come to terms with difficulties and come to hopefully a wiser understanding of the human predicament, you know, as it manifests through this being, I find a much greater capacity to accept and respond to others, you know, even people who I don't like. It's funny, one can still be kind even if somebody, you know, maybe frightens you in some way, you know, even people who are you know, quite unpleasant, have unpleasant habits or difficulties. Compassion is more about recognizing suffering. And, you know, sometimes it can be interpreted as, you know, the inclination to do something about suffering, to make things all right. And certainly this is a more skillful response than, you know, wanting to cause harm or to perpetuate somebody's suffering. You know, to want to make it all right is a step in the right direction. But my sense is that real compassion actually demands more of us. And looking at the actual word itself, compassion is kind of like, com means like with, and passion is like feeling with, really willing, being willing to enter into somebody's suffering, somebody's difficulty. You know, sometimes we kind of protect ourselves. We sort of say, oh, you poor thing, let me help you. Really setting ourselves apart, you know, that it's not me, but I'm going to help you. Like the sort of the great benevolent being, the one that's going to help everybody. And, you know, we can do that. But that's actually falls short of what we can, what we are capable of, which comes about when we actually begin with our own suffering. So if you're with somebody, say, who's in a very difficult situation, very sick or dying or bereaved or, you know, had some terrible experience, when we tune into our own relationship with that, sometimes there can be the, oh, thank goodness it's not me, which is not compassion. You know, thank goodness it's not me. And then you can sort of make a great show of trying to do something about it, but just because you feel maybe a bit guilty about having had that thought. Whereas another way of responding might be to actually recognize the sense of hopelessness, the sense of fear, the sense of inner distress through the contact with a person or a situation which is very extreme in terms of suffering. Sometimes we also have to come to have compassion for our own sense of helplessness, and actually take time to be with that in a compassionate way, you know, our own suffering. And then in relation to the other person, the response is often very different. You know, sometimes there is something that we can do, but it's not coming from a place of compulsion or a sense of separation. It's as though we've entered into the suffering, the difficulty of that person. We're taking it on, we're sharing it. You know, like this is a brother or a sister in old age, sickness and death. This is my friend. This is somebody whose suffering I share. I mean, you don't say all this, of course, but just that attitude, which may mean that you're just quietly there. It may mean that you're doing something, you're with them. It may mean that you say something, but you're not saying or doing it out of a compulsion to try and make yourself feel better. Do you see the distinction? So compassion in some ways is more active, even if it manifests as actually being very still and quiet. And I often tell stories about when I've been really sick and just noticing different people's responses. And I remember one time somebody came and they thought they were being so compassionate, so sympathetic, and they came and they told me exactly how they'd had exactly the same thing, or even worse. And, you know, when you're really ill, that's not necessarily what you particularly want to hear. Or, there, dear, you'll get better soon. Or, whereas sometimes really the thing that's most helpful is just, you know, somebody's willingness to just to be open to the situation, to actually take it on board. And to do that, as I said, it demands a kind of compassion for your own fear and distress or confusion or helplessness. So to repeat again what the stewards say on the aeroplane, you know, make sure that you fix your own oxygen mask before helping others with theirs. In my experience, this is the way that seems to work best. So does that help with getting a sense of the distinction between the two? Yeah.
After leading question onto that.
Yeah.
So with compassion, so it's not
an action. I don't think it really works, actually.
All right.
Mm.
What would your advice be in some cases? Oh yeah, what compassion is wanting to alleviate people's suffering. So what would your advice be when, say, you see someone suffering and you really want to help alleviate that? But maybe sometimes they want to be helped. So how can you do it skillfully so that your action is like comes with kindness rather than do this because it's good for you or do this because yeah.
So responding to the question about what we can do if we really want to help somebody but they don't want to be helped. They don't.
They can be oppression.
Yes.
You know, you can do it with kindness rather than come across as know-it-all or something. Or wanting to impose your values.
Yeah, you're right, some people don't want to be helped. And they might not want to be helped by you. because, you know, sometimes people are frightened that you're going to sort of take advantage of them, or you're going to lay a trip on them of some sort, that you're going to, you know, that you think that you're better than them because you know what they need and you're going to provide it. And so it's like that they feel demeaned or diminished by your interest and your help. And again, it's a matter of actually coming back to your own sense of helplessness. I'd really like to help this person. I don't know what to do. They're going through a really difficult time and I would love to help them, but everything I do seems to go wrong. And actually just being able to stay with that feeling of helplessness, and you know, sometimes we can share that with the person. Say, you know, I'd really love to be able to. You know, I can see that things are really difficult. I'd love to be able to help, but I really don't know how to do it. You know, just actually acknowledging that you're also suffering. You know, you have this sense of helplessness, and you'd like to be able to help, but so it's like, in a way, just opening yourself a little bit to the other person, sort of showing something of yourself rather than, I'm the one who's going to help you, and protecting yourself in that way. It's a tricky one, and sometimes we get it wrong, and sometimes, you know, people, you know, if they really don't like it, they can say things that are quite hurtful. So you need to kind of go gently. And this is where upeka is very useful, which is like equanimity, you know, not being too concerned about the results. You know, you do your best. And if it doesn't work out, you know, if they're still in a mess and it's getting worse and you've, you know, supported them as best you can, then, you know, to realize, okay, well, I've, my capacity to support this situation is limited. And sometimes just acknowledging that and just keeping your eyes and ears open and just like standing back. Occasionally you find that things come right even without your help. And that's very gratifying. It's not gratifying if you particularly want to be the one who's made it all right. You know, I've gone in and I've solved this problem and everything's all right now because of me. Whereas just, you know, there's a real concern about this person or this situation. I don't know what I can do to help, but hopefully they'll receive the help that they need. So it's like more like turning it into a prayer. You know, may they be well. We can always wish people well. We can always dedicate our practice for their welfare. And that's something we can always do. You don't have to tell them. They might not particularly appreciate it, but it's certainly something that can, at some subtle level, support a kind of healing or a well-being in people. Anything else?
How does compassion sit with dispassion in Buddhism? Because sometimes you're supposed to be detached and dispassionate, and at the same time, compassion is a very important thing. So how does the two sit?
So responding to the question about how compassion and dispassion work together, how they sit together, because they seem to be quite contradictory. On the face of it, yes. I think if we care too much about things, sometimes we make them worse. I remember the first time I got involved with a family that were having terrible difficulties, and I desperately wanted to make things all right. You know, because I could see that everybody was really struggling and, you know, the whole thing was kind of breaking up, falling apart. And this, you know, I cared and I, you know, I used to have sleepless nights. I used to think up things I could do to kind of try and make things okay. You know, I was hopelessly over-involved. I mean, anybody in the caring profession has probably been through that. You know, you do it once and you never do it again. So you get hopelessly involved, and that's where there is not dispassion. That's where there's attachment, involvement, mixed with what looks like compassion, just desperately wanting to make it all right. So in order to really help, there has to be a measure of standing back. So we, it's a subtle thing. Because as I said before, compassion does involve entering into the suffering of another person, you know, being willing to bear it and being willing to bear your own suffering in relation to it. As I see it, it's also to do with like trusting Dhamma. Rather than feeling that you have to make it all right, you know, sort it all out yourself. And is actually just trusting that that human beings have the capacity to make things all right. that each person has the wisdom to find the way forward. And sometimes all they need is just the space and the sense of ease around the situation in order to discern what's needed. So it's like entering into a relationship with somebody where, rather than you kind of, as I said before, being the one who's going to make it all right, but entering into like a relationship where there's a kind of a witnessing of what's happening for them, and also a confidence that they have the capacity to resolve their difficulty. And somehow, you know, it's almost like a kind of chemistry. Just the presence of somebody who's not over involved, who's not entangled with it, and yet who's willing to bear it. Sometimes just that presence is enough to enable them to untangle the muddle, you know, whatever it might be. If it's a physical complaint, it that can be enough just to enable a sufficient sense of ease to allow the healing process to happen, or the acceptance of the illness, whatever it might be.
That makes sense to me, but what would you say to some issues that are not personal? For example, if you see the famine in Africa, the news on that, you know, there's so many things that, and sometimes you just feel really sick. And there's nothing you can do. But what is that? Is that something to do with one's own ego? Because one knows that there's nothing to be done, nothing an individual can do. Is it some sort of kind of self-view that is propagated, or is there really compassion there?
I often wonder. Well, I think sometimes it's a, you know, please can this suffering go away so I don't have to bear it. which kind of looks like compassion, and yet really it's self-interest, because you can't bear what you're witnessing. No, I'm not saying that that's what you're doing at all. No, no, I don't. No, I'm sure it's not, because you know. I think, you know, people in this situation are, you know, people are compassionate. So it's not that. But I'm talking to what can happen that looks like compassion, and I mean, it's really hard when you become more aware of the awful things that are happening in the world. and there's plenty of them, and we, you know, if you do watch TV or listen to the news or read newspapers, then you have plenty of exposure to that. One thing you can do is kind of ration your intake of that kind of information. You know, have media-free days. Or maybe just have one media day a week, you know, that, or maybe cut it out altogether. But you know, just taking care of yourself in terms of what you can, you know, knowing your capacity for taking in those kind of impressions. My sense is that actually there's a lot that as human beings we can do at a subtle level. And a lot of it is about just actually being willing to take it on board as being, this is part of suffering humanity that I'm part of. And that demands a kind of expansion of the heart, and a kind of also like equanimity. So just being able to encompass these extremes of human experience. And my sense is the more that we're able to do that, and the more people that can do that, it's a kind of holding. And, you know, there may be situations where you'll find yourself, I don't know, writing a letter to somebody or speaking out in a public situation or You might meet somebody who can have an influence. You know, this can happen in all kinds of ways. So don't assume that there's nothing you can do, but just the willingness to kind of take it on board as part of your consciousness. And as I said, you know, knowing your capacity. So, you know, we can be totally swamped and overwhelmed. I think it was Ajahn Amaru was saying how they actually have to have, you know, in America, there are psychologists who kind of specialize in counseling people who are totally overwhelmed with the climate change concern, you know, because, you know, that's a very, it's a very serious concern. And, you know, if you really look into it, you know, you can see it's not trivial, you know, what's happening to the planet. So, in fact, they at the recent teachers' conference, there was a real kind of encouragement, you know, for people who teach Dhamma, like people in my position, to actually bring it into people's consciousness. So, you know, it's a big concern. And as I said, it's there are psychologists who specialize in counseling people because they've taken on too much, more than they can bear. So it's not that you shut it out because you don't care, but it's more a sensitivity to your own capacity. You know, sometimes our capacity needs to expand a little bit in certain situations, but not to jump in with 2 feet to a situation that is more than you can manage. The other thing I think that is helpful is to, to realize that all of that is, you know, you are receiving it through the media. And so you're like getting a concentrated form. You know, you turn on the news for your concentrated dose of human suffering. But to realize that, you know, that's not, you know, it's not that everybody is experiencing life in this way. It's actually just quite a small, well, relatively small proportion of people. Actually, having said that, they say that, you know, half the world is starving, or even more than half the world is malnourished. So, that might be an understatement, but you know, certainly, you know, many of the more extreme situations that you hear about, it's not that everybody is going through this. The other thing is to just actually attend to your own suffering, you know, because in your own life, I'm imagining there are situations where, you know, you can alleviate suffering around you, you know, in your own heart and, you know, close friends, family, you know, rather than being so concerned about the bigger picture, is actually just attend to what you can and to really include yourself in suffering humanity. I was saying earlier today how, you know, we can get into a space where we say, well, may all beings be relieved from all suffering except me. I mean, it's not so gross as that, but there can be that kind of assumption that we have to relieve everybody else's suffering, and we forget to attend to our own, to see that we do have the capacity to do something. And just, you know, relieving our own suffering, you know, learning how to avoid suffering over, I don't know, our crazy mind, or suffering over something that maybe happened 10 years ago, that is already alleviating the suffering of the world, because you're part of the world. So that's another way of looking at it. But it's a big question. And I remember when I first came to the monastery, I mean, I was always quite glad that we didn't read newspapers or have TV. And then I went home one time, and you know, there was some terrible news on the, because my family were all, you know, they'd always watch the news every day, and terrible news. And a beautiful evening, and I sort of watched the news, and I just felt so kind of awful and kind of responsible. And I was sort of trying to think, well, you know, what can I do about this? And this, you know, this kind of grey sort of depression about this, you know, information that I just received. And I went upstairs to my room and just looked around, and the birds were singing. It was a beautiful evening. I was with my family, and I thought, come on, Chandasiri. You know, that's just one aspect of humanity's, you know, experience. And it's definitely, there's definitely a bias, because, you know, good news doesn't really sell so many newspapers. You know, it's almost as though people love to receive bad news. And so that's what people write about. That's what they, you know, put on the front page. They wouldn't sort of put, you know, 45 people spent 10 days on retreat at Amaravati. And had these insights. You know, that wouldn't be something that people would be very interested in. You know, you want to know about the rapes, the murders, the atrocities. You know, that's the thing that sells papers. And so, you know, to realize that we do get a slightly biased picture, but no less serious for that. You know, but to see the importance of actually protecting ourselves. So it's not because we're wimpish or weak or because we don't want to know, but just more that. If we get totally overwhelmed and burnt out, that actually doesn't help anybody. That's just another suffering human being. So, you know, don't suffer yourself about it. See if you can find a way to enjoy life and to perpetuate that for others rather than suffer over others' suffering. I hope that makes sense. It doesn't sound too callous because it's not my intention at all. But it's to find a way that we can actually respond effectively that doesn't totally destroy us. Yeah. Anything else? Let's hear from Sarojini, and then we can have your question.
In the chant about sharing the blessings,
yes,
there's a line. I would share my practice with the evil forces.
Yes, yes. So concern about sharing practice with evil forces. It's a reasonable concern, and I've pondered this myself. And the way that I made sense of it was. You know, every now and again, I sometimes have evil impulses, believe it or not. And I expect each of you at times have impulses to hurt, destroy others. You know, it's not beautiful, it's not what you want to celebrate and particularly support or further, but that can arise. It arises for me when I'm feeling confused and unhappy. That's where it comes from. When I'm feeling at ease and happy, those things don't arise. So sharing our practice, sharing the blessings of our life with the evil forces is hopefully enabling them to in some way be healed. To come to a place of clarity, a place of wisdom, where they don't need to do the evil things that they're doing. Like metta is a very powerful antidote to evil, to cruelty, unkindness. And we can also reflect on the fact that, you know, when people do really awful things, that there's a price to pay. They have to remember it. And, you know, there are consequences. And, you know, according to the Buddhist teaching is, you know, if you torture others or harm others, if you're cruel and violent, if this evil manifests a lot through you, then the chances are you're going to have to spend several eons in hell. So sharing our practice with evil forces is perhaps lessening the amount of evil. And so, lessening the likelihood of these beings or forces or whatever having to spend eons in hell. It's also helpful to us because, you know, evil is very unpleasant and we can easily get into negativity about the bad things that we hear about, the bad things that people do, you know, and blame and judge and want them to be punished. Which doesn't do us any good. You know, as I said before, ill will is like an illness. It's like a sickness. And it spreads. It's infectious, you know. Because we start talking to other people, and then soon everybody is ganging up against this evil person, you know, something that somebody's done. And that's actually perpetuating evil. So rather than doing that, you know, with the evil forces, you think, okay, I'm not going to hate the evil forces, I'm not going to want to punish the evil forces or destroy them. Let's just practice sharing our practice with them so that in some way they may experience a sense of blessing. You know, if you think of all those, you know, wretched beings in hell, you know, intent on causing harm and inflicting pain on others. I mean, that's a pretty awful state to be in. So, you know, there's something quite nice about just showering them with a little bit of cooling, blessing, kindness. You know, it might make them feel a little bit better, get a clearer perspective on what they're doing and help them to change their ways. It's just a thought. So I quite like that, and I mean sometimes people get confused, talk about virtuous leaders of the world, and sometimes you think, well, you know, are there any virtuous leaders in the world? because you know often you hear of things, you know, where sometimes the leaders aren't as skillful as they might be, and you just think, well, if they have a little bit, you know, if their lives are a little bit more blessed, I mean, not through having lots of wealth and power, because that's not blessing. You know, but sometimes you know, that can seem like a curse, you know, because it takes a lot of wisdom to be able to use wealth and power. So, you know, to share our practice for the benefit of, you know, the leaders of the world, whether they're virtuous or not. And if they're not virtuous, that they might become a little bit more virtuous, that they might see the value of living responsibly, carefully, and fulfilling their duties in a way that's going to be for the welfare of everybody rather than just taking advantage of the situation that they're in. So there's plenty of scope for, you know, beings to receive any blessings that are going. And, you know, you might think, well, I don't have many blessings. You know, my practice today wasn't very good. I didn't... Don't think about it like that. Just the very fact of being here and of having that aspiration to wake up is in itself a blessing. That's a very inclination to share any blessings that we have. You know, rather than thinking, well, I've got to keep all the blessings for my... I need all the blessings. You know, just sharing them. And then, you know, more... That in itself is a way of accumulating a sense of blessedness and goodness in your life. Does that answer your question? Good. Okay. Okay, Nenana.
It's about the non-self that we practice or try to build up in Buddhism. Thinking about bringing up children, to be charismatic or successful from the childhood, say that the general idea is that they have to develop a strong sense of self, positive sense of self.
Yeah.
Thinking back about charismatic people, Lord Buddha, or I don't know, childhood of Ajahn Chah, for example, Lord Buddha, he was brought up with the mentality of a prince. So it's understandable. As he became Buddha, he still had, even though with the non-self, he still had this upbringing of a positive self, strong. So he did be charismatic. So in this current situation, how do we guide our children to develop that positivity as well as how do we teach them about non-self? Mm-hmm. It's a bit conflicting to me.
Yes, it's a kind of paradox, isn't it? I'll just say it so it goes into the system. Just the question about raising children, loving them, caring for them, giving them a sense of confidence, a positive sense of themselves, and at the same time, how does that work with non-self? Yeah, as a teaching on non-self. My sense is that if if human beings are really loved and appreciated for what they are, there's not such a need for a big ego. That the ego is something that develops as a way of defending oneself and bolstering oneself up. So the Buddha, he grew up in very fortunate circumstances. He certainly had a great many privileges, and he was certainly very gifted in his child and throughout his growing up, and very popular and successful in everything he did. My sense is that the ego kind of develops, and as we're growing up, the sort of sense of self, and it usually in relation to others, sort of need to defend oneself against others and to kind of prove oneself. And I think a lot of the values in society are about quite competitive. A lot of emphasis on being the best, getting a good mark in your exams, being skilled in sport, being skilled in different things. And you're praised for these things. And so you develop a sense of pride, confidence, that this is the thing that you're valued for. Whereas I think if parents can actually meet their child as a human being, with all of the wonderful things and the less wonderful things, my sense is that there's less likelihood of there being a need for such a strong ego identity. It's a tricky one because I haven't brought up children myself. That's right, yes. That's right. To be a good self rather than a not good self, an adequate self.
How would you tell a child that, okay, you can be a good person, but you're...
Mustn't attach to it. Yes. I mean, I think like everything else, it's an evolution. It's a kind of, we talk about growing up, and as you're growing up, you go through different phases. And first of all, you're totally involved with your mother, really kind of an extension of her. You don't really think of yourself as being separate. And then gradually you grow up and you meet other children and other people. And so there's a sense of, where you fit into the society. And so learning how to fit in, how to interact in good ways, cultivating positive values, positive ways of being in relation to others. And it may be that the contemplation of not self is something that comes a bit later on. As one begins to, and I think, probably for people here, there are probably people who, it's a very subtle teaching, and one doesn't always get it straight away. It doesn't really make sense. And there can be a lot of investment in the self. It's only really when we begin to appreciate the suffering involved in having a self and demanding of the self that it be a certain way and protecting the self. It's that dukkha, that suffering, that leads us to investigate, or can be the source of wanting to investigate. So my sense is that when you're raising little children, you need to love them and care for them. And encourage them to be generous, unselfish, to share the things that they have, whether material things or else, in a game that they take turns, that they don't always have to be the one that does the special thing. So just encouraging those kind of values, sharing, generosity, kindness to each other, kindness to all creatures. So that's actually providing the foundation for their life. Like an ethical foundation, and allow the contemplation of not self to happen when it needs to. Like very little children, you have a sense that they don't actually really, it's not particularly an issue for them. I mean, they're concerned about being hungry, and they certainly, sorry?
They're
There's certainly not the concept of self. I mean, there's a very strong sense of a being needing to survive and, you know, learning, knowing how to get what it needs to survive. I mean, the fact that crying babies is extremely distressing to everybody. It's not an accident. It makes things happen, you know, because there's nothing else they can do to make it happen. They can't go and make a cup of tea or whatever, you know, so they have to find a way to get somebody else to do it. Interesting, eh? Yes. I don't know if that it helps at all to throw light on the question. I think so. I think I need to contemplate about it too. They've started, like up in Scotland, they've started inviting me into primary schools to teach Buddhism to children. Like the first engagement I had was a few weeks ago, somebody invited me to the primary school in Muthill, which is just 10 miles away. This student teacher, she had been given this class of five-year-olds and she had to teach them about Buddhism. So she went on the internet and she found out about, you know, Amarawati, I suppose. I mean, I don't know what she found. Anyway, she found me in the end. So I was spending time with these five-year-olds. And, yeah, I need to learn about how to support them in their growing up. I mean, they were cute as could be. It was fun. But it's something. Yes. I've got some 10-year-olds next week. 55 10-year-olds in Perth. So, it's a learning for me as well. It's a good question, though, just to figure out how to raise them and how to love them and care for them so they don't end up feeling that they're the centre of the universe, you know, so that they are able to share and, you know, not selfish, but at the same time have a healthy sense of their own value as human beings. You know, because if you have that, you don't have to fight or establish your position in relation to other people, because you know you're okay. Like I was brought up, I was actually the first, I'm going on a bit now, but I'll finish after this. I was the first grandchild in our family. There's been, I think, about six boys, and then my mother had me. And so it was really celebration because I was a girl. And so I've always felt okay about being a girl, being a woman, which was very helpful. You know, I always knew I had a place. So, like in our community, when we were going through some difficult times some years ago, and, you know, the nuns were sort of, you know, it was quite a struggle between the nuns and the monks, and, you know, how we could live together in a good way. And people saying, oh, the nuns should, you know, have their own monastery, be somewhere else. And I thought, no, we have a place. I had no doubt that we were a significant part of the equation. So that's, you know, from...
It matters a lot,
it
matters a lot, like you were saying, it matters a lot in development, thinking about child psychology.
Yes.
At the same time, I have a son.
Yes.
So I always encourage him to think that he's a good person.
Yes. Yes, yes. Don't worry, that'll come. start off with Dana.
I'm building his ego.
Yeah. I think he'd get confused at this point, perhaps. You know, there'll be a time to support him in investigating, you know, what the self is. You know, because it's only when we can really understand what the self is that we can actually appreciate not self. And I mean, we're all working with that right now, and we're adults. So, you know, it may be something that just comes gradually. Or you may find he'll ask surprising questions, and that you realize that actually he has an understanding that you hadn't realized, and that you don't have to teach him. He knows already. You know, children are full of surprises. Yeah. Yeah, how old is he?
Oh, my son's 16.
16?
He's still finding it hard to meet.
Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, you have to trust that he has his own, you know, inner wisdom, capacity for understanding and for reflection. Mm. Well, just, yes, yes, you may find that something from the retreat you can try, but don't worry about it, because I think to get back to mindfulness, usually if you just focus on being mindful, you'll know when it's the time to speak about certain things. You'll know how to speak about those things. You don't have to plan it. It's after 5, so I think maybe we should end the discussion at this point. If there are any unanswered questions, any concerns that need a response, you can try writing a note. I'm not sure if and when we'll have another question and answer session, so I'm willing to respond to a few notes, not too many. And we can go one step at a time from there. So, thank you. See you later on. We'll meet again at 7:30 for the puja meditation.